Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
When was the last time you were able to shop and compare with 350 fire service exhibitors all under one roof? Schedule time this February 28th through March 2nd to walk the exhibit floor at Firehouse World 2011. Check out the latest in apparatus, apparel, tools, and more. Plus, find out about servicing equipment your department currently owns. An exhibitor list is available at firehouseworld.com.
Good morning and welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We're recording this in the early part of November for our listeners. And that being said, today's rundown, we're going to talk about a few recent, once again, incidents and accidents, some things that Brother Wilbur has accumulated, things that have happened out there in the last couple of weeks. Since we are right around the corner, at least in a good part of the United States, of catching some colder weather and things that are going to happen in the winter, we're going to talk a little bit about winterizing your apparatus, both things you can do ahead of time in the station and some things you need to be aware of when you're operating both your engine and ladder apparatus out on the fire ground, of some things you can do to try to prevent physical damage to the rigs. We're then going to follow up with some discussion that has really emanated as a result of the most recent Apparatus Architect article, part number 48, that is in the current issue, the November 2010 issue of Firehouse Magazine, talking about how to ensure that you receive competitive bids. A lot of departments find themselves today under a lot of political pressure beyond the financial environment to make sure that they get several bids on their apparatus. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit. We're then going to be talking about some other opportunities that your community can have to acquire apparatus, potentially without having to go through sometimes a very painful and at the very least quite lengthy bid process. And then we're going to do a little wrap-up and final comments here before we sign off for the day. So what do you have for us? What's happened here in the last couple of weeks that have been noteworthy?
Thanks, Brother Tom, and hello, everybody. Just a few issues of note. As you recall, Fire Lieutenant Kevin Kelly was killed in an emergency vehicle accident when his ladder 26 lost the brakes on January 9th of 2009. It has been put out over the wire service that his family is now in the process of suing, and those named in the lawsuit are an auto spring manufacturing company, Boston Freightliner, Broadway Brake Corp, Daimler Diesel Suspension Specialist, Inc., and Woodward's Auto Spring Shop, Inc. The suit claims that the companies were negligent, providing faulty work, installed the wrong parts, and failed to recognize mistakes through proper inspection, according to the report. And, of course, there were a couple comments from each of the companies. The family claims that the actions of the companies left Ladder 26 with a severely reduced brakes in the right rear wheels and no brake power in the left rear wheels, which contributed to the tragic accident. And also from Ladder 26, it's a very busy unit in the city of Boston. They had their ladder placed to the roof of a triple-decker late last month, and the aerial was placed across and in contact with a primary electrical line. The voltage of that line was 2,800 volts. The chauffeur and the officer climbed the aerial to the roof and ventilated without noticing the aerial in contact with the high voltage wire. This hazard was eventually noticed, and the IC was just about to call the roof sector and notify them not to use Ladder 26's aerial, but before this radio message could be transmitted, the following occurred. The chauffeur was descending the aerial and was just above the wire when it started to arc. In the meantime, the officer was on the roof and had placed his hand on the aerial and was just about to climb onto the aerial to descend it when the arcing began. The member on the aerial did not receive a shot. The officer on the roof felt a small charge pass through his arm, and he was able to descend on a different aerial and was convinced to be checked out of the local hospital. He was treated, released, and is doing fine. The aluminum aerial melted in two spots where it came in contact with the primary wire when it came in contact with the roof flashing. Ladder 26 is now out of service. And again, it's one thing that I teach constantly in the ladder ops class. If you come in contact with high tension wires and you are on the truck, just as the brother was that was climbing down, the chauffeur climbing down, as long as you do not come in contact with any kind of grounding, you will be fine, which was the case with him. Unfortunately, the officer was hurt because he was in contact with the building, which is grounded to the ground, obviously, and he formed the ground, and he was hurt, but thank goodness, not too seriously. So if you are on the truck and wires happen to fall on it or you come in contact with wires, you need to stay on the truck. If you do try to jump off and you come in contact with the ground, there's a really good likelihood that this scenario will not play out as successfully as this one, and you could end up getting seriously hurt or perhaps even killed.
Mike, I got a quick question for you. Going back to the first article relative to the family and relatives of the deceased lieutenant in Boston, I guess I find it a little curious that the people named in the suit were predominantly all folks outside contractors that allegedly at one point or another may have performed some work on that unit. Whether or not it was relative to the break, I guess is for the courts to decide. But based on your experience, Mike, I know you have been approached innumerable times by attorneys looking to get your expert testimony for whatever their side happened to be. But what I find a little bit curious here is that the suit only named the vendors, and they didn't name anything relative to the municipality, the city of Boston, or anybody within the Boston Fire Department. Certainly that report that was done initially after that incident that was done by an outside independent company for the city, even reading a little bit in between the lines, it certainly seemed like the Boston Fire Department's motor maintenance section left a little bit to be desired with respect to following standard practices that the NFPA would suggest for maintenance of apparatus, in addition to their assumed lack of having professionally trained and ASC certified or EVT certified mechanics. Any comment or observation that you care to offer, kind of like without impugning yourself, is, again, kind of a little curious that they just named independent contractors and not anybody relative to the city or somebody that worked in and for the city.
Well, a couple thoughts come to mind, and again, for our listening audience, this is purely, the first thought is purely conjecture on my point, on my part, but a lot of times, and in particular with Lieutenant Kelly, he was a mainstay in the Boston Fire Department, had quite a lineage from what I gather, and was on, had a TV show heralding the acts of the Boston Fire Department. And so, and his family, I would surmise, was treated very well by the Boston Fire Department as they went through the agony and grief of burying Lieutenant Kelly, and then in the days and weeks after, just trying to pick up the pieces. And a lot of times, families of fallen firefighters, if there's another avenue to go, such as there is here with outside vendors, tend to perhaps stay away from suing the fire department itself because of that strong bond and the brotherhood. That could be one thing. The other thing, just in lawsuits like this in general, each state is different. And each state you have, as a litigant, you have to file a notice of claim where you're going to make known to people that you feel aggrieved you in this particular incident or accident to let them know that they're now going to be sued. In the state of New York, I believe it's 90 days to follow a notice of claim, or if you are a minor child less than 18 years old, you can file a notice of claim however many years. Say you were 14 years old, you have 4 years plus 90 days after your 18th birthday. I believe in the state of Connecticut, it might be 3 years. In the state of New Jersey, it might be 1 year or vice versa. But everybody's different. And when you file a notice of claim, the idea is to list everybody that you feel has done you wrong somewhere in this incident. And if on the day after that time period that you find somebody else is culpable, it basically doesn't count anymore. They're off the hook. And so generally you find that everybody is named in that notice of claim that they could possibly, that has any connection to this event whatsoever, generally. And then the investigation and the subsequent days and weeks and months that pass, they start weeding people out. And really it's about finding, not only finding who's more culpable as far as blame, but in a lot of cases it's just who has the most money or the best insurance.
Thanks for clearing that up, Mike. Like I said, I just found that interesting that they, like you said in your summary, there weren't more people, the field of people, potential folks that they were going to go after, so to speak, I would have suspected may have been a little bit larger than what was initially said. So any other recent incidents that you'd like to comment on before we jump over into the talk about the rising thing?
Yeah, I have just a couple more, Brother Tom. A fire officer in Maine was charged with driving to endanger for an August 8th crash that destroyed the apparatus. He was issued a citation by the Maine State Police. He had been with the fire department for 5 years prior to the crash. He was driving a 2005 tanker pumper, carried 1,800 gallons of water. He had left the scene of a report of a dryer fire. He was rounding a bend when she lost control of the vehicle. The vehicle rolled over and came to rest upside down. She suffered minor injuries and because she was belted in. The truck, however, narrowly missed four motorcyclists who were riding in formation. One of the riders ended up taking his motorcycle into the ditch in order to avoid the apparatus. The riders credit their own safety training and Captain Kinney's attempt to maintain control of the apparatus with saving their lives. So that could have been really nasty. A New Jersey EMS chief was DUI at the scene, was charged with driving while intoxicated after responding to a call in a marked EMS command vehicle. They were responding to a report of a suicidal man who later barricaded himself in and set fire to the house.
As a side note, Mike, if the guy wasn't suicidal before that, when he saw the EMS command vehicle show up and then the guy was intoxicated, that probably didn't help him straighten up his cause any.
It could actually maybe drove him over the edge. I don't know. It appeared when the chief showed up that he was influence of an intoxicating substance. He was administered by the PD a field sobriety test, which he immediately failed. He was charged with DWI and use and or being under the influence of a controlled and dangerous substance and was released on his own recognizance. So it sounds like it may not have only been alcohol, but it also could have been some drugs or something as well. So that's an issue. And then it's gotten it always gets a great deal of press. And a lot of, particularly our newer listeners, may not understand, but there is a mechanism of funding for specific jurisdictions called subscription service. And a home within the last month or so in the state, or a building in the state of Tennessee, which was not covered by a subscription service, was let burn to the ground. And the first time I had heard about it was probably a decade and a half ago in the state of Alaska, where there was actually a car on fire in a garage, and the garage was attached to the house, and the owner was outside. He claimed there was nobody inside, but the fire department went to check and make sure, and then promptly watched that house burn down, and the guy had his checkbook there and said, you know, how much, I'll pay you whatever, and you know, the fire department refused that, because then if everybody did that, the fire department would not have funding to operate and survive, and so that house burnt down. So it's always a very controversial way to do it, but you have, you know, these are basically rural fire departments that are protecting unincorporated parts of our country that have no other way to fund themselves. There's no entity there to tax or to gather public funds, and so they sell subscriptions, much like you would buy for a newspaper or a magazine, and, you know, you get a yearly, basically, subscription notice in the mail, and if you send a check, you're covered, and if you don't send a check, you're not covered, and if you have the unfortunate occurrence to have a fire in your home or business, why, you are going to have a total loss. It seems cruel, but unfortunately, it's the only way that these departments can survive. So that's all I have this morning, Tom, as it relates to news on the fire service front.
Well, thank you, Mike. It's kind of, I guess, somewhat encouraging that in the course of the last month or so, we haven't had, well, there have been obviously some incidents. We haven't had any extreme tragic incidents out there. There's been a lot more press coverage, I think, this year rather than any other year that I can think of in recent memory with respect to heightened awareness of safety operating on and around apparatus. A lot of great material out there. Dr. Bert Clark, with his Seatbelt Pledge efforts that you, together with the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, are doing with the Seatbelt Initiative, and maybe this is the year, hopefully, that folks are starting to just wake up a little bit. Over the course of since the last podcast, Brother Mike was up teaching in the state of Alaska, as well as several other locations. I had the good fortune of taking probably all too short, but a very, very nice vacation out to the island of Oahu and Maui. Visited a number of federal fire department, DOD stations operated by the Navy on Oahu, and a number of stations on Maui. And every time that I saw a piece of apparatus move, even if they were moving it from the station to come outside to allow me to take a few photos, the people had their seatbelts on, and it was, to me, kind of encouraging to go to different parts of the country. More recently, added some very rural areas here in North Carolina, where my mother lives, seeing guys go out on runs, and I don't think I've seen secured firefighter yet, which is, to me, somewhat encouraging. Maybe we're finally getting the message. So, having said that, we'll shift gears, go into talking a little bit about winterizing your apparatus. Now, if you're out in the desert southwest, you're in any part of California, up in the low desert or the high desert, as they call it out there, probably don't really need to worry about this topic all that much, but there's a large part of the country where once the weather gets substantially below 32 degrees and water freezes, and in other portions of the country down where the folks are, our good friend Peter Matthews, who helps us with these podcasts up in Minnesota, one only has to look at the design of the apparatus to understand that some of these units have been specifically designed to operate in sub-freezing, if not sub-zero, conditions. So we'll talk a little bit about some things that you can do preparing your apparatus before we get to that point. And the first thing, and Mike and I will kind of bounce back and forth on this, first thing I'll just talk about is snow and ice chains. For a number of years, there's been very good products out there that can be installed on your apparatus and that give you some additional traction and degree of security when you're operating in snowy conditions where you typically have a couple inches of snow down on the ground. These devices, while they work very great, work real well, are not necessarily designed to help you if you don't have traction chains and you've got a 12-inch or an 18-inch snowfall. This product probably isn't going to help you in that case. But if you're in a portion of the country where you get a limited amount of snow and it comes in a couple inches in increments, whether your apparatus was purchased new with those or they can certainly be retrofitted on virtually every make and model of fire truck out there, be it custom or commercial, there are specific models out there available, and there's three or four different manufacturers that largely have a product line that caters to us here in the emergency services for both everything from as small units as command vehicles and ambulances up to the largest tandem axle units that you may have in your fleet. That's one product. And the other thing that you may want to consider that would seem to be old school, and here Mike and I might be showing our age, but when I grew up, I can actually remember times of chaining the family car where I lived in southern New York to be able to get out to go make a run to the grocery store or, you know, to get us kids to school in the time. And if you don't actually have snow traction chains that you can put and install on your apparatus, you may want to be thinking of that. For those folks in the extreme portion of the East Coast going up when they had those several nor'easters last year down going through Mike's area and then continuing on up through New England where the people got several feet of snow, there were honestly times where some friends of mine, you know, gave Mike and I a call and we were trying to help them locate traction chains for their rigs, even if it was up in our area, because the people down in those areas, for example, down in the central and southern portion of Virginia, they didn't even carry that kind of product at an auto or truck parts store. And pretty rapidly, people found out that even your newest apparatus that was equipped with the automatic chains really wasn't helping you get through these large snow barriers and snow drifts. Where I happen to live up in the western part of New York, we annually get, not that it's a lot by comparison to other areas, but we get about 95 to 100, 110 inches of snow each year. For the folks that live north, our listeners that live north of Syracuse in an area that I'm familiar with, there's portions of, as they refer to it, the Tug Hill Plateau. They get over 200 inches of snow each year. And while they do a great job of keeping the roads clear, there's a lot of times that the fire apparatus has to get down an unplowed road, or even if the road's plowed, most people in many cases, if it's still snowing and they have an emergency incident, their access way to their driveway isn't cleared, and now you still need a four-wheel drive vehicle or something to be able to get off-road to get into where you need to be. So if you don't have large pipe traction chains that actually physically go around the tires and you snug them up with spring devices to keep the chains taut, you may want to think about procuring those. If you have them and they haven't been used in a couple of years, you probably want to go through a little exercise and chain up the vehicle and make sure that you don't have any missing or broken links and that they're in good condition, because it's the kind of thing when you decide that you have a bad snowfall and you're going to chain up at 2,200 hours, that's not the time to find out the chains are out of service for some reason, or they broke last year and nobody reported it, because chances are you're not going to find a auto or truck parts place open at that time of the evening to help you. So I know, Mike, even down in the city of New York, where you typically don't get as much snow as you do in the other northern parts of the state, you folks have chains on your rigs. What's, just for our listeners' benefit, what's the FDNY policy or protocol as to what determines when you're going to chain up one of your rigs?
Yeah, Tom, if we have more, and boy, you're going back to the days when I studied for promotion, I believe the number was more than 4 or 6 inches of snow, one of those numbers that you had to put a full set of chains on the vehicle, and the city is very good with that. The dispatchers, they, once that occurs on the streets, he'll send out a bullet and basically tell everybody that they need to chain up. And the problem isn't that we get so much snow here. It's just that there's nowhere to put it. And so much of the city's snow removal at times, particularly when it's less than 6 inches of snow, is just using road salt, which is another whole, we could do another whole show on that, just trying to figure out, you know, how bad that particular stuff is on the apparatus bodies. I just looked at the 46 engine last night. We were coming back from a run, and the headlights hit it out in front of the apparatus apron, and it's an 03, and it is showing significant rust already on that vehicle for a vehicle that's only 7 years old. So that's an issue. So it's not so much that we get tons and tons of snow and feet, but just what we get. If it happens to stick around, there's just nowhere to put it. And so we may be driving through it. And then what sanitation does is that once they get it piled up alongside the road, what little room there is, on warmer days when it's going to be above freezing, they'll actually take and plow it flatly back into the road, and the friction of cars running over it and more salt put on it melts the snow out of the way. So that's kind of how we handle that. A couple other tips for our listeners about winter operations that we do. Most of our good aerial and tower companies will take and put 50 pounds of rock salt on their vehicles, take a bag. And that's to put around the outriggers and the jacks on our aerial and tower ladders to keep those jacks and jack plates in contact with the ground. In our books, it's written where if you are operating on a hill, particularly with a tower, and you have your elevated master stream going and the water runoff all of a sudden comes down the driveway underneath your rig and starts to freeze, and then if you're operating the boom at a low angle in the 0 to 20 degree range and it's full out off the side of the truck, you could actually get the apparatus to bounce up onto that ice, and if you're on a hill, you could start going down the hill. We get the rock salt out and put it around the outrigger jacks so to keep the apparatus outriggers and jacks in contact with terra firma so that when ice does form and the truck could potentially jump up on the ice if it's being operated at a low degree of angle, say 0 to 20 degrees, and it can just start going down the hill. If that happens to you when you happen to be in the boom or in the bucket, rather, you want to get the boom aligned back with the chassis and get the weight centered on the chassis, and that may help stop things. You know, and if you're a funny guy and you're driving the rig, if you want to get up behind the wheel and put your foot on the brake, you can go ahead, although it won't do much for you, but it may make you feel better, I don't know, but it doesn't happen often, thank God, you do want to maintain contact with the ground with the jacks and the outriggers. And if you're the operator, another thing that we teach in class is that you need to get up off the pedestal, the operating position, every 20 to 30 minutes if you're in a long-duration barn burner, Main Street extravaganza fire where you're going to be operating for a number of hours. You want to get down every 20 to 30 minutes and make sure in all times of the year that your jacks and outriggers are still in contact with the ground and that stable surface that you first pulled up on, that you put the jacks and outriggers down, is maintained through the duration of the incident. And then the last point to be made as far as winter operations is when we operate aerials and towers is elevated master streams, a lot of times the wind will take that spray and actually put it back on the ladder or the aerial tower or the tower ladder boom, and it will start to freeze, and there's an accumulation of ice. If water weighs 8 pounds a gallon, then ice would have to weigh something fairly similar, and you can cause a very extreme overloading condition on the boom or the aerial if you allow that ice to continue to accumulate. And so what we suggest and teach people is that if you're in an operation like this, that you want to retract and extend the boom often, and it breaks up that accumulation of ice and doesn't let it form to the point of being dangerous to operating forces and dangerous to the truck. Any more thoughts, Brother Tom?
Yeah, Mike, interesting that you mentioned, because that was going to be one of my questions. If you read specifications for current, model aerial apparatus, many of the manufacturers have a statement as a portion of their specifications which state that the operating parameters and the weight loading on the units are based on premises in worst case conditions, including 50 mile an hour winds and either like a quarter inch or half inch ice buildup on the device. And obviously there's engineering calculations that people can go through together with some strain gauge testing to validate those premises. Obviously it's not the kind of thing that anyone can actually go out and field test, during an evaluation period or an acceptance period. But when you mentioned about taking the ice off the aerial, short of chipping away with, not a hammer, but I'm assuming, some rubber hammer device, so you're not actually contacting the metal and doing metal on metal, or having some type of thawing device, which I've seen in several departments. Any other personal recommendations or a system that you may have seen somewhere in your travels of what people do to de-ice, an aerial device? I can recall going back years ago, seeing a picture or hearing about them, getting an aerial device that was partially extended and yet still be able to rotate and lower the device, and hearing stories about aerials being removed from the fire scene with a device partially extended and taken to a warehouse somewhere where they could fire up some steam jennies or something to de-thaw the device, where it was clear that the weather wasn't going to be favorable to do that. But anything that you've seen done on the fire ground, or any recommendations in terms of a tool or a little trick of the trade of what people can do?
Well, that's why the extending and retracting of the boom and the aerial is so important, because you don't want to let it get that far. Once the thing gets frozen like that up in the air, and it is, from a career from firefighting point here, it's like your worst nightmare, because you've already been wet, cold, and frozen for a period of time, and now you got to take up and realize that you can't. And now you have to wait for a thawing unit, and basically our thawing units are basically giant steam jenny pressure washers that create, hot steam, and, you would have to wait until the ladder is treated with that and melt all the ice off of it, which could ultimately get you tied up at that particular incident for yet another hour or two. And so other than extending and retracting the device and constantly monitoring it, there's very little else you can do. And if you don't do that and you get caught with your pants down, so to speak, and the ice does build up like this, you as an operator and a department are going to really hate that end result. And so you want to adhere to this message this morning, and as the operator, it's your responsibility, and be very observant and very cognizant of any ice buildup on the apparatus, and make sure that you extend and retract often to prevent the situation from becoming much more dire and much more troublesome.
Good point, Mike. And I guess to that, the only thing I would think of is that a lot of times in incidents, particularly in, unlike your situation where you've got a well-trained and well-staffed ladder company, there's in many communities they find themselves when they're going out with ladder companies that are understaffed by anybody's reasonable judgment of anywhere from, one to three people are places where Mike and I have been, and we'll see this beautiful ladder aerial device, but we don't happen to see any gear hanging on it or near it, and you inquire as to how is that staffed, and they tell you, well, if we need it, we call the off-duty shift or, one of the other engine companies from an outlying station. They swing by and put a driver in it. Well, that's, at that point, you have a taxi, not a not a ladder company, and no matter what your staffing situation is, I think a lot of times in major incidents we have safety officers or somebody dedicated to handle the safety sector, and these people tend to get maligned a little bit, maybe more so than they should, because people view them as like, well, these guys are just waiting to see something that they don't like, and then they're going to, jump all over your back. There's something then for the at major winter operations that the safety officer should be cognizant about when you are flowing master streams, like Mike mentioned, off of aerial devices to make sure that kind of every once in a while stop by and make sure that the operator is extending and retracting the device or moving it a little bit, moving the stream. If you're in a master stream operation, unless you've got an incredible heavy volume of fire, as they say in the trade, if you've got a building off, you want to be moving that stream, from window to window and sweeping and knocking down the visible fire and not just letting it sit there and pour water for 45 minutes on end, because even in freezing conditions, water's got to be going somewhere. So very good point. So with that, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit about how to ensure that you receive competitive bids. It's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, and we'll be right back.
With a tough economy, everyone can use a break when it comes to training and education, especially firefighters. In addition to early reg discounts, Firehouse World 2011 is offering a new group discount for conference packages. Register with just three people and you'll save 10% per person. Groups of six or more will save 20% per person. Firehouse, affordable for everyone. Get complete details at firehouseworld.com.
Hey, we're back. It's the Apparatus Architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, and we're going to finish up our session this time talking about how to ensure that you receive competitive bids on your next apparatus project. And this is kind of like a follow-up to the article that is appearing in the November issue, current issue of Firehouse Magazine, talking about this topic. And it seems that the number of either municipal officials, fire chiefs, apparatus, committee members, or even in several cases, surprisingly, and we normally don't view them in the fire service as being our ally, but in a lot of cases they are, your friendly solicitor, attorney, lawyer, whatever you call them locally, that kind of advises people, advises your municipal officials what you need to do to stay within the legal boundaries of the road to make sure that the process goes smoothly. So we're just going to amplifying a couple of different points. We would encourage your listeners, if you haven't read the article yet, please read it. If you have any comments or questions or things you'd like to throw at us, please send those questions to podcast@firehouse.com, and we'll be happy to answer them both personally back to you if you have any questions, as well as being able to answer them on the air for the benefit of our listening audience. So having said that, in my perspective, and different people may call these different terms. These are not nationally approved terms. You're not going to find this in Webster's Dictionary, but, Tom Shannon and Mike Wilbur's interpretation of the types of specs that you see out there. The first one is kind of referred to as an open specification, where it is not written around any one manufacturer's product. It may have different makes and models that are very specific. For example, it may specify by make and model a particular type of Detroit diesel or Caterpillar diesel. It will go into detail describing the type, make and model of Allison transmission, the Meritor axles, the make by brand and size, tire rating and speed rating for the types of tires you're going to put on the vehicle. Those things those major components, including fire pumps and so forth and warning lights, are typically available to all manufacturers. So while you can be very specific in terms of your requirements there, you are not specifically excluding any one manufacturer. And it helps you maintain consistency in your fleet. If you have a maintenance group, for example, that is used to working on a particular make and model of fire pump, and they have repair parts and valve kits in for a particular brand of valve that you use on your engine fleet, that is all good stuff, and there's no problem with putting that in there. If you ever think that you are getting close to the area where you may be restricting somebody from bidding, a statement that you can put in there that is perfectly legal and still gives you, the purchaser, the ability to say yay or nay to an alternative that is being offered by someone would be to list by make and model the particular product that you're looking, and then put in the wording or fire department or whatever your jurisdiction's legal enterprise is referred to, or fire department approved equal. That gives you the ability to either say yes, that the equivalency being offered by one of the vendors is acceptable, or to say no, that's not what we're looking for. It doesn't meet the intent of what we were looking to do. Open specifications certainly ensure you typically to get the greatest number of vendors that want to come and offer a bid for your serious consideration, and also enables you then to fairly evaluate the level of competency based on the quality of the bid proposal that people return. An open specification, because it doesn't have all of this proprietary dialogue in there. For example, when you get into the description of the body, where typically most manufacturers will go on from anywhere from 3 to 5 pages, having explicit detail as to how their bodies are fabricated and different material thicknesses, and when they begin to list compartment dimensions, there's nothing wrong with putting, you know, a range of compartment dimensions in there, but when you start specifying your compartment dimensions down to 2 decimal points, for example, a compartment L1 ahead of the rear axle shall be 44.75 inches wide by 63.75 inches high and 26.50 inches deep in the lower section and 12.50 inches deep in the upper section. You're getting pretty specific there, and chances are those dimensions probably mimic or mirror image just one manufacturer's dimensions. So in order to be fair to the potential competitors, as well as being able to correctly assess your requirements, it might be more reasonable to say the forward compartment shall be a minimum of, for example, 44 inches wide by 60 to 65 inches high and X number of inches deep in the base, and shall have approximately X number of cubic feet of storage space, but most importantly, delineate what you expect to carry in that compartment. So for example, if you were going to have the right rear body compartment to be set up for a rescue tool, that based on your other apparatus and your experience, you know that compartment needs to be at least 44 to 46 inches wide, full height and full depth. If somebody comes in and offers you a compartment that's 34 inches wide and is not full height, full depth, it gives you the basis for comparison to say, well, this person clearly didn't take note of what I was attempting to want to carry in there. You're clearly not going to fit that in that area. So in that case, it gives you the ability to, it takes some time, arguably, but to properly assess their response back that you got from the different vendors with respect to their quality, as I refer to it, or their bid proposal. The second type of specification is where it has some influence from one or two different vendors, and you may try to mix and match a little bit from, you know, people say, well, I like that guy's body, but I like the way this guy builds this pump enclosure, for example. When you start cutting and pasting and putting little bits of pieces from one to the other, you typically may find yourself that you're going to get in trouble because no one is going to build a vehicle that's a little bit of A, a little bit of C, and a little bit of M. And there, you can expect a wide variation, not only in the quality of the proposals, but chances are a very wide variation in the pricing of the product, to the point where you're going to scratch your head and kind of wonder, geez, what's going on here? And this is where you begin to get in trouble. When you use that style of specification, where it's kind of like freewheeling a little bit all over the board, that's exactly what you're going to find out. And my parallel would be it's like going into an auto mall where one dealership has four or five different car product lines, and they can put you in a four-door, four-tired automobile for as low as $12,000. And if you really wanted the high-end one, they can roll you out the door for something that's up around $80,000. But you're going to sit there and say, well, it all goes down the road. It steers. It stops. The doors open and close. The windows roll up and down. But there's almost a $70,000 spread. Same thing can happen on a $400,000 or $500,000 project on a fire truck. And until you critically review what you're getting and read the bidder's proposal, you just can't rely upon did they check yes and no in your bidder's comply section, did they take the appropriate number of clarifications and or exceptions. They might not be giving you anywhere close to what you look for, but they checked yes, they wrote no exception, and you're thinking you're getting what your specs ask for, but that's not what you're signing the contract to. You're signing the contract to their proposal. That's why you need to read every page of their proposal to find out exactly what you're getting. And if you're not getting what you want, then that needs to be indicated as you do your spreadsheet analysis and determine what the dollar value of that might be missing from the spec. So in that type of situation, it may seem easier to put the spec together, but you're buying into a lot more work to be able to critically evaluate the bids. And if you don't do that and you just let the low price spread kind of dictate what direction you're going, more than likely that's what you're going to get. The old adage is you don't get something for nothing. If somebody's $50,000 less in a bid, I guarantee the next guy up the line wasn't making $50,000 of profit and putting it in his pocket. It's a matter of you're not getting everything that you may have suspected or thought or desired that you want. The final version is where you just kind of decide ahead of time what manufacturer and what product you want, and you write your spec solidly around that product. Now, that does two things. It ensures that you're going to get everything you want, assuming you award the contract to that vendor. On the other hand, it really discourages competitive bidding, because any other vendor who has been in the market for a while is going to be able to pick up a spec, and if they're worth their salt, within 30 to 45 seconds after they thumb through a spec that was clearly written for competitor and be able to identify what you wanted by make, model, probably not price, and they're not going to be very encouraged to offer a bid. So if you're in a situation where you're being allowed to specify exactly what you want, and you may have the money to buy that particular product, but you only get one bid on it, you probably want to know that ahead of time and not have to then go plead your case and explain to people how you got that way. There's some work that Brother Mike and I have done for people that, went through the whole process, took 8 months to go look at vehicles, go to shows, write specs, meet, do truck committee meetings, detail every little thing on the vehicle, put out a 121-page spec. They get a 121-page bid proposal back from only one guy. It's within budget, and either the solicitor or the mayor or whoever the controls administratively, the final is the decision maker, they just look at you and say, thanks for all your effort, but we're not buying anything where we only get one bid. You probably want to kind of like figure that out ahead of time and not wait till the 11th hour and then say, oh my God, we're in trouble. So there are some of the potential pitfalls one way or the other when you go write a manufacturer spec. So Brother Mike, any just comments on those last words?
Well, like we've said on a number of occasions, if you have a house full of one product and you put that product spec out on the street, you can't be shocked at all if you only get one bid back. I think the term in the industry is chasing a spec, and it's even as bad as businesses, the fire truck business being off a substantial percentage of what it was a couple years ago, upwards of some figures have it 38, 42%. where instead of selling 5,500 trucks, we're down to maybe 3,800 trucks a year. The reality is that the salesman, with all that whining and dining, like you say, looking at other trucks, bringing drawings, bringing specs, redoing them again, changing them up, the pre-bid conference, the mid-inspection, the final inspection, all those things that occur, and the salesman doesn't realize one dime out of any of it until the truck is delivered and paid for, and then that's probably 30 days next. So the salesman could work with a customer for upwards of, on an aerial product, you know, 18 months or 2 years for basically for free. And so people in the industry are just not willing to go chase a spec. If you have a station full of one product and you put that product, that manufacturer spec out on the street, you're probably only going to get one bid. And you and I, we go through this all the time where we'll talk with fire commissioners or mayors or fire chiefs and, you know, why didn't we get more bids? Well, what do you expect? You kind of sealed your own fate.
Well, it exactly, and well put, Mike. So your community may be in a position where, and again, you want to check this out to find and to embrace your corporation counsel, your lawyer, your attorney, and find out if this is legal and can be done. You may probably want to second source this, and if your local apparatus salesperson representing the product line that you like says, oh yeah, no problem, we did this down the road and such are here there, you still want to second source this and make sure that it's legal, giving the ordinances in your particular community. But there are opportunities to order tag-on units for a vehicle that was ordered by another community, maybe not even within the state. In a lot of cases, it has to be within the state, but to tag on to a unit that has a lot of the capabilities of what your community is looking for, and you can tag on and simply order what the other people did, and within a monetary figure, plus or minus a certain percent, you can change it to make it fit exactly what you want. And tag-ons are a great opportunity to save money because manufacturers already absorbed the engineering costs to figure out what that one community did. You may potentially have the ability to get an accelerated delivery if that's important to you because, again, you don't have all the lag time of trying to figure things out. And it gives you the ability to get a very capable vehicle at a reasonable price. Additionally, the other thing you can do, and typically people do this when they're in a situation where they need a vehicle immediately, would be to acquire and pick up a demonstrator unit, a vehicle that has either already been built by the vendor or potentially is slated to be built and is in the production schedule. And once again, if these units meet your particular department's requirements, you can get a vehicle, again, typically at an attractive price because the time frame between when you would sign a contract and when the vehicle is going to be produced is shortened. It gives you the ability, in some cases, but not all, to potentially change the design and the features of the unit to get a couple of options on there that may or may not have been initially determined to be on the rig. So that's another opportunity that you have. Again, not designed to circumvent the bid process, but another avenue to enable you to procure the vehicle without having to go through the standard protocol where it can take you upwards of 8 to 10 months to go through the whole process. So
Brother Tom, I'd like to speak to a couple points that you just made there. So one is buying a demonstrator unit, and I think the very important words that you use there that you just simply cannot overlook is, does it really fit your needs? A lot of times, particularly in fire truck accidents where we wreck one or there's a mechanical where the engine blows up, there's this there seems to be this tremendous need by the fire department and the firefighters to rush out and buy the first thing that comes into town that they can have tomorrow. And that may satisfy the need or the itch for that period of time, but understand that the mistake that you make today could end up coming back to haunt you for the next 20, or in case of an aerial truck, maybe as much as 30 years. There are certainly other ways that you can acquire something that's going to fit your needs, such as potentially leasing from one of the lease companies a used rig, or renting one, as you will, to tide you over, or perhaps an auto aid apparatus to come into your jurisdiction while the truck that's really going to fit the bill is going to be built, and not to jump to the first thing that's new and shiny that pulls into the firehouse and say, okay, we'll take that one. We've worked with a lot of departments that have made that a very big mistake, and it comes back to haunt them for years and years to come.
Okay.
And the other thing with respect to getting good bids, I think, as you recall, probably the best bidding that we really have seen in recent times was in the state of New York here, where a department took two fire truck specs for a rear-mounted aerial tower from two different manufacturers and took those specs and massaged them to be what they wanted the truck to be, and had the companies bid straight up on their own specs against each other. And that makes the process certainly easier. There were no exceptions basically taken. Each manufacturer was bidding on their own specifications. You had both manufacturers engaged, and you had both manufacturers and their salespeople really sharpen their pencils. And I'm not sure whether that kind of bidding is street legal in all states, but in New York, you can take two separate specifications from two different manufacturers, and you can send them out to bid up against each other, and you could really get two very good prices on, as long as you don't care what manufacturer builds your truck. You could get some really good equipment for a really noteworthy price.
Okay. Well, thanks, Mike, for those comments. And so just to wrap up here, we'd like our listeners to continue to stay safe out there, sit down, buckle up, and do the best job you can once you get safely to the incident. Brother Mike and I are going to be out in San Diego at Firehouse World from February 26th to March 2nd. You can check online at firehouse.com the specifics on the program and the schedule, but we will on different days be presenting programs on one on rollover accidents, one talking real specifically about what you need to know as the purchaser before you sign the contract. You've gone through the bidding process and you're about ready to ink a contract, and as they say, jump into bed with a manufacturer to produce your new apparatus. Different things you need to know that will help you through the process of the manufacturing and the engineering conference portion and the inspection portion to help make you a more educated customer. And one thing that will put a smile on my face and will probably pain Brother Mike, but the five things you need to accomplish at every incident with your engine company. So the Ladder Boys are going to be keeping a maxi brake on that program, and we're just going to be talking specifically about flow and water and the five things you need to do to be good, to be better, and to be safe at every incident you go out to. So we look forward to seeing some of folks out there at Firehouse World San Diego, February 26th to March 2nd. Brother Mike, will let you end and wrap up. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, as we move forward, we're getting close to moving in the new year, and like you had said at the start of the show, hopefully it really does look like we are getting better with seatbelts and seating, and just firefighter safety in general, and the statistics seem to be bearing that out, as well as just going around the country and seeing how different people drive and operate their trucks. And so really looking forward to the new year, and hopefully our economy will pick up, and things will be a lot brighter for everybody out there moving forward.
Very good. Thanks, Mike. So to our listeners here, it's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shanney, Apparatus Architects. Until the next time, be safe, and we look forward to seeing you folks on the radio.
Participate in Command Officer Training, a highly interactive two-day pre-conference class at Firehouse World 2011 this February. Learn the skill sets necessary to be a successful command officer. Register before December 15th, and you'll also be included in pre-event webinars and classroom preparation. Complete details can be found at firehouseworld.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.